Lying in her bunk bed in Madame Ping's dormitory, reading these words from a softly glowing page in the middle of the night, Nell wondered at that. Princesses were not genetically different from commoners. On the other side of a fairly thin wall, she could hear water running in half a dozen sinks as young women performed their crepuscular ablutions. Nell was the only scripter staying in Madame Ping's dormitory. The others were performers, and were just coming back from a long, vigorous shift, rubbing liniment on their shoulders, sore from wielding paddles against clients' bottoms, or snorting up great nostril loads of mites, programmed to seek out their inflamed buttocks and help to repair damaged capillaries overnight. And, of course, many more traditional activities were going on, such as douching, makeup removal, moisturizing, and the like. The girls went through these motions briskly, with the unselfconscious efficiency that the Chinese all seemed to share, discussing the day's events in the dry Shanghainese dialect. Nell had been living among these girls for a month and was just starting to pick up a few words. They all spoke English anyway. She stayed up late reading the primer in the dark. The dormitory was a good place for this. Madame Ping's girls were professionals, and after a few minutes of whispering, giggling, and scandalized communal shushing, they always went to sleep. Nell sensed that she was coming close to the end of the primer. This would have been evident even if she hadn't been closing in on Coyote, the 12th and final fairy king. In the last few weeks, since Nell had entered the domain of King Coyote, the character of the primer had changed. Formerly, her knight friends, or other characters, had acted with minds of their own, even if Nell just went along passively. Reading the primer had always meant reacting with other characters in the book, while also having to think her way through various interesting situations. Recently, the former element had been almost absent. Castle Turing had been a fair sample of King Coyote's domain, a place with few human beings, albeit filled with fascinating places and situations. She made her lonesome way across the domain of King Coyote, visiting one castle after another and encountering a different conundrum in each one. The second castle, after Castle Turing, was built on the slope of a mountain and had an elaborate irrigation system in which water from a bubbling spring was routed through a system of gates. There were many thousands of these gates, and they were connected to each other in small groups, so that one gate's opening or closing would, in some way, affect that of the others in its group. This castle grew its own food and was suffering a terrible famine because the arrangement of gates had in some way become foobarred. A dark, mysterious knight had come to visit the place, and apparently sneaked out of his bedroom in the middle of the night and fiddled with connections between some gates in such a way that water no longer flowed to the fields. Then he had disappeared, leaving behind a note stating that he would fix the problem in exchange for a large ransom in gold and jewels. Princess Nell spent some time studying the problem, and eventually noticed that the system of gates was actually a very sophisticated version of one of the Duke of Turing's machines. Once she understood that the behavior of the water gates was orderly and predictable, it was not long before she was able to program their behavior and locate the bugs that the Dark Knight had introduced into the system. Soon water was flowing through the irrigation system again, and the famine was relieved. The people who lived in this castle were grateful, which she had expected. But then they put a crown on her head and made her their ruler, which she had not expected. On some reflection, though, it only made sense. They would die unless their system functioned properly. Princess Nell was the only person who knew how it worked. She held their fate in her hands. They had little choice but to submit to her rule. So it went, as Princess Nell proceeded from castle to castle, inadvertently finding herself at the helm of a full-fledged rebellion against King Coyote. Each castle depended on some kind of a programmable system that was a little more complicated than the previous one. After the castle of the water gates, she came to a castle with a magnificent organ, powered by air pressure and controlled by a bewildering grid of pushrods, which could play music stored on a roll of paper tape with holes punched through it. A mysterious dark knight had programmed the organ to play a sad, depressing tune, plunging the place into a profound depression so that no one worked or even got out of bed. With some playing around, Princess Nell established that the behavior of the organ could be simulated by an extremely sophisticated arrangement of water gates, which meant, in turn, that it could just as well be reduced to an unfathomably long and complicated Turing machine program. When she had the organ working properly and the residents cheered up, she moved on to a castle that functioned according to rules written in a great book in a peculiar language. Some pages of the book had been ripped out by the mysterious Dark Knight, and Princess Nell had to reconstruct them, learning the language, which was extremely pithy and made heavy use of parentheses. Along the way, she proved what was a foregone conclusion, namely, that the system for processing this language was essentially a more complex version of the mechanical organ, hence, a Turing machine in essence. Next was a castle divided into many small rooms with a system for passing messages between rooms through a pneumatic tube. In each room was a group of people who responded to the messages by following certain rules laid out in books, which usually entailed sending more messages to other rooms. After familiarizing herself with some of these rule books and establishing that the castle was another Turing machine, Princess Nell fixed a problem in the message delivery system that had been created by the vexatious Dark Knight, collected another ducal coronet, and moved on to Castle Number 6. This place was entirely different. It was much bigger. It was much richer. And unlike all of the other castles in the domain of King Coyote, it worked. As she approached the castle, she learned to keep her horse to the edge of the road, for messengers were constantly blowing past her at a full gallop in both directions. It was a vast open marketplace with thousands of stalls filled with carts and runners carrying product in all directions. But no vegetables, fish, spices, or fodder were to be seen here. All the product was information written down in books. The books were trundled from place to place on wheelbarrows and carried here and there on great, long, seedy-looking conveyor belts made of hemp and burlap. Book carriers bumped into each other, compared notes as to what they were carrying and where they were going, and swapped books for other books. Stacks of books were sold in great, raucous auctions and paid for not with gold, but with other books. Around the edges of the market were stalls where books were exchanged for gold, and beyond that, a few alleys where gold could be exchanged for food. In the midst of this hubbub, Princess Nell saw a Dark Knight sitting on a black horse, paging through one of these books. Without further ado, she spurred her horse forward and drew her sword. She slew him in single combat, right there in the middle of the marketplace, and the booksellers simply backed out of their way and ignored them as Princess Nell and the Dark Knight hacked and slashed at each other. When the Dark Knight fell dead and Princess Nell sheathed her sword, the commotion closed in about her again like the waters of a turbulent river closing over a falling stone. Nell picked up the book that the Dark Knight had been reading and found that it contained nothing but gibberish. It was written in some kind of a cipher. She spent some time reconnoitering, looking for the center of the place, and found no center. One stall was the same as the next. There was no tower, no throne room, no clear system of authority. Examining the market stalls in more detail, she saw that each one included a man who did nothing but sit at a table and decipher books, writing them out on long sheets of foolscap and handing them over to other people who would read through the contents, consult rule books, and dictate responses to the man with the quill pen, who enciphered them and wrote them out in books that were then tossed out into the marketplace for delivery. The men with the quill pens, she noticed, always wore jeweled keys on chains around their necks. The key was apparently the badge of the Cipherers' Guild. This castle proved fiendishly difficult to figure out, and Nell spent a few weeks working on it. Part of the problem was that this was the first castle Princess Nell had visited that was actually functioning as intended. The Dark Knight had not been able to foul the place up, probably because everything was done in ciphers here, and everything was decentralized. Nell discovered that a smoothly functioning system was much harder to puzzle out than one that was broken. In the end, Princess Nell had to apprentice herself to a master cipherer and learn everything there was to know about codes and the keys that unlocked them. This done, she was given her own key as a badge of her office and found a job in one of the stalls enciphering and deciphering books. As it turned out, the key was more than just a decoration. Rolled up inside its shaft was a strip of parchment inscribed with a long number that could be used to decipher a message, if the sender wanted you to decipher it. From time to time she would go to the edge of the market, exchange a book for some gold, then go buy some food and drink. On one of these trips, she saw another member of the Cipherer's Guild also taking his break, and noticed that the key hanging around his neck looked familiar. It was one of the 11 keys that Nell and her knight friends had taken from the fairy kings and queens. She concealed her excitement and followed this cipherer back to his stall, making a note of where he worked. Over the next few days, going from stall to stall and examining each cipherer, she was able to locate the rest of the 11 keys. She was able to steal a look at the rule books that her employers used to respond to the encoded messages. They were written in the same special language used at the previous two castles. In other words, once Princess Nell had deciphered the messages, her stall functioned like another Turing machine. It would have been easy enough to conclude that this whole castle was, like the others, a Turing machine. But the Primer had taught Nell to be very careful about making unwarranted assumptions. Just because her stall functioned according to Turing rules did not mean that all of the others did. And even if every stall in this castle was, in fact, a Turing machine, she still could not come to any fixed conclusions. She had seen riders carrying books to and from the castle, which meant that cipherers must be at work elsewhere in this kingdom. She could not verify that all of them were Turing machines. It did not take long for Nell to attain prosperity here. After a few months, which in the Primer were summarized in as many sentences, her employers announced that they were getting more work than they could handle. They decided to split their operation. They erected a new stall at the edge of the market and gave Nell some of their rule books. They also obtained a new key for her. This was done by dispatching a special coded message to the castle of King Coyote himself, which was 3 days' ride to the north. 7 days later, Nell's key came back to her in a scarlet box bearing the seal of King Coyote himself. From time to time, someone would come around to her stall and offer to buy her out. She always turned them down, but found it interesting that the keys could be bought and sold in this fashion. All Nell needed was money, which she quickly accumulated through shrewd dealings in the market. Before long, all 11 of the keys were in her possession, and after liquidating her holdings and turning them into jewels, which she sewed into her clothes, she rode her horse out of the sixth castle and turned north, heading for the seventh, the castle of King Coyote and the ultimate goal of her lifelong quest. Nell goes to Madame Ping's theater. Rumors of the Fists. An important client. Assault of the Fists of Righteous Harmony. Ruminations on the inner workings of Ractives. Like much that was done with nanotechnology, feedlines were assembled primarily from a few species of small and uncomplicated atoms in the upper right-hand corner of Mendeleev's grid. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, and chlorine. The Fists of Righteous Harmony had discovered, to their enduring delight, that objects made of these atoms burned rather nicely once you got them going. The flat, low Yangtze Delta country east of Shanghai was a silk district well stocked with mulberry trees, which, when felled, stacked, and burned beneath the feed lines, would eventually ignite them like road flares. The Nipponese feed was heavy on the phosphorus and burned with a furious white flame that lit up the night sky in several places, as seen from the tall buildings in Pudong. One major line led toward Nanjing, one toward Suzhou, one toward Hangzhou. These distant flares inevitably led to rumors among the hordes of refugees in Shanghai that those cities were themselves burning. The new Atlantan feed had a higher sulfur content that, when burned, produced a plutonic reek that permeated everything for dozens of miles downwind, making the fires seem much closer than they really were. Shanghai was smelling pretty sulfurous as Nell walked into it across one of the bridges linking downtown Pudong with the much lower and older Bund. The Huangpu had been too wide to bridge easily until Nano had come along, so the four downtown bridges were made of the new materials and seemed impossibly fragile compared with the reinforced concrete behemoths built to the north and south during the previous century. A few days ago, working on a script in Madame Ping's offices far above, Nell had gazed out the window at a barge making its way down the river, pulled by a rickety old diesel tug, swathed in dun tarps. A few hundred meters upstream of this very bridge she was now crossing, the tarps had begun squirming and boiling, and a dozen young men in white tunics had jumped out from beneath, scarlet bands tied about their waists, scarlet ribbons around their wrists and foreheads. They had swarmed across the top of the barge, hacking at ropes with knives, and the tarps had reluctantly and unevenly fallen away to expose a patchy new coat of red paint, and, lined up on the top of the barge like a string of enormous firecrackers, several dozen compressed gas tanks also painted a festive red for the occasion. Under the circumstances, she did not doubt for a moment that the men were fists and the gas hydrogen, or something else that burned well. But before they'd been able to reach the bridge, the tanks had been burst and ignited by something too small and fast for Nell to see from her high post. The barge silently turned into a carbuncle of yellow flame that took up half the width of the Huang Pu, and though the diamond window filtered all of the heat out of its radiance, Nell was able to put her hand on the pane and feel the absorbed warmth, not much hotter than a person's skin. The whole operation had been touchingly hapless, in an age when a hand-sized battery could contain as much energy as all those cylinders of gas. It had a quaint 20th-century feel and made Nell oddly nostalgic for the days when dangerousness was a function of mass and bulk. The passives of that era were so fun to watch, with their big, stupid cars and big, stupid guns and big, stupid people. Up and downstream of the bridge, the funeral piers were crowded with refugee families heaving corpses into the Huang Pu. The emaciated bodies, rolled up in white sheets, looked like cigarettes. The Coastal Republic authorities had instituted a pass system on the bridges to prevent rural refugees from swarming across into the relatively spacious streets, plazas, atria, and lobbies of Pudong and gumming up the works for the office crowd. By the time Nell made it across, a couple of hundred refugees had already picked her out as a likely alms source and were waiting with canned demonstrations. Women holding up their gaunt babies, or older children who were trained to hang comatose in their arms. Men with open wounds and legless gaffers dauntlessly knuckle-walking through the crowd, butting at people's knees. The taxi drivers were stronger and more aggressive than the rurals, though, and had a fearsome reputation that created space around them in the crowd, and that was more valuable than an actual vehicle. A vehicle would always get stuck in traffic, but a taxi driver's hat generated a magic force field that enabled the wearer to walk faster than anyone else. The taxi drivers converged on Nell, too, and she picked out the biggest one and haggled with him, holding up fingers and essaying a few words in Shanghainese. When the numbers had climbed into the right range for him, he spun around suddenly to face the crowd. The suddenness of the movement drove people back, and the meter-long bamboo stick in his hand didn't hurt either. He stepped forward, and Nell hurried after him, ignoring the myriad tuggings at her long skirts, trying not to wonder which of the beggars was a fist with a concealed knife. If her clothes hadn't been made of unterrible, uncuttable nano-stuff, she would have been stripped naked within a block. Madame Ping's was still doing a decent business. Its clientele were willing to put up with some inconvenience to get there. It was only a short distance from the bridgehead, and the madam had put a few truculent taxi drivers on retainer as personal escorts. The business was startlingly large, given the scarcity of real estate in Shanghai. It occupied most of a 5-story reinforced concrete Mao Dynasty apartment block, having started out with just a couple of flats and expanded room by room as the years went on. The reception area reminded one of a not-bad hotel lobby, except that it had no restaurant or bar. None of the clients wanted to see or be seen by any other. The desk was staffed by concierges whose job was to get the clients out of view as quickly as possible. And they did it so well that an uninitiated passerby might get the impression that Madame Ping's was some kind of a walk-in kidnapping operation. One of these functionaries, a tiny woman who seemed oddly prim and asexual, considering that she was wearing a black leather miniskirt, briskly took Nell to the top floor where the large apartments had been built and elaborate scenarios were now realized for Madame Ping's clients. As the writer, Nell, of course, never actually entered the same room as the client. The woman in the miniskirt escorted her into a nearby observation room, where a high-res cine feed from the next room covered most of one wall. If she hadn't known it already, Nell would have seen from the client's uniform that he was a colonel in Her Majesty's Joint Forces. He was wearing a full dress uniform, and the various pins and medals on his coat indicated that he had spent a good deal of his career attached to various protocol enforcement units, been wounded in action several times, and displayed exceptional heroism on one occasion. In fact, it was clear that he was a rather important fellow. Reviewing the previous half hour, Nell saw that, not surprisingly, he had arrived in mufti, carrying the uniform in a leather satchel. Wearing the uniform must be part of the scenario. At the moment, he was seated in a rather typical Victorian parlor, sipping tea from a Royal Albert China cup decorated with a somewhat agonistic briar rose pattern. He looked fidgety. He'd been kept waiting for half an hour, which was also part of the scenario. Madame Ping kept telling her that no one ever complained about having to wait too long for an orgasm, that men could do that to themselves any time they wanted, and that it was the business leading up to it that they would pay for. The biological readout seemed to confirm Madame Ping's rule. Perspiration and pulse were rather high, and he was about half erect. Nell heard the sound of a door opening. Switching to a different angle, she saw a parlor maid entering the room. Her uniform was not as overtly sexy as most of the ones in Madame Ping's wardrobe department. The client was sophisticated. The woman was Chinese, but she played the role with the mid-Atlantic accent currently in vogue among Neo-Victorians. "Mrs. Braithwaite will see you now." The client stepped into an adjoining drawing room where two women awaited him, a heavy Anglo in late middle age and a very attractive Eurasian woman about 30. Introductions were performed. The old woman was Mrs. Braithwaite, and the younger woman was her daughter. Mrs. was somewhat addled, and Miss was obviously running the show. This section of the script never changed, and Nell had been over it 100 times trying to troubleshoot it. The client went through a little speech in which he informed Mrs. Braithwaite that her son Richard had been killed in action, displaying great heroism in the process, and that he was recommending him for a posthumous Victoria Cross. Nell had already done the obvious, going back through the Times archives to see whether this was a reconstruction of an actual event in the client's life. As far as she could determine, it was more like a composite of many similar events, perhaps with a dollop of fantasy thrown in. At this point, the old lady got a case of the vapors and had to be helped from the room by the parlor maid and other servants, leaving the client alone with Miss Braithwaite, who was taking the whole thing quite stoically. "Your composure is admirable, Miss Braithwaite," said the client, "but please be assured that no one will blame you for giving vent to your emotions at such a time." When the client spoke this line, there was an audible tremor of excitement in his voice. "Very well, then," said Miss Braithwaite. She withdrew a small black box from her reticule and pressed a button. The client grunted and arched his back so violently that he fell out of his chair onto the rug, where he lay, paralyzed.
"Mites! You have infected my body with some insidious nanocyte," he gasped.
"In the tea."
"But that is impossible. Most mites highly susceptible to thermal damage. Boiling water would destroy them."
"You underestimate the capabilities of Cryptnet, Colonel Napier. Our technology is advanced far beyond your knowledge, as you will discover during the next few days."
"Whatever your plan is, be assured that it will fail."
"Oh, I have no plan in particular," Miss Braithwaite said. "This is not a Cryptnet operation. This is personal. You are responsible for the death of my brother Richard, and I will have you show the proper contrition."
"I assure you that I was deeply saddened," she zapped him again.
"I do not want your sadness," she said. "I want you to admit the truth, that you are responsible for his death." She pressed another button, which caused Colonel Napier's body to go limp. She and a maid wrestled him into a dumbwaiter and moved him down to a lower floor, where, after descending via the stairway, they tied him to a rack. This was where the problem came in. By the time they had finished tying him up, he was sound asleep. "He did it again," said the woman playing the role of Miss Braithwaite, addressing herself to Nell and anyone else who might be monitoring. 6 weeks in a row now." When Madame Ping had explained this problem to Nell, Nell wondered what the problem was. Let the man sleep, as long as he kept coming and paid his bill. But Madame Ping knew her clients, and feared that Colonel Napier was losing interest and might shift his business to some other establishment unless they put some variety into the scenario. "The fighting has been very bad," the actress said. "He's probably exhausted." "I don't think it's that," Nell said. She had now opened a private voice channel direct to the woman's eardrum. "I think it's a personal change."
"Oh, they never change, sweetheart," said the actress. "Once they get the taste, they have it forever."
"Yes, but different situations may trigger those feelings at different times of life," Nell said. "In the past, it has been guilt over the deaths of his soldiers. Now he has made his peace. He has accepted his guilt, and so he accepts the punishment. There is no longer a contest of wills, because he has become submissive."
"So what do we do?"
"We must create a genuine contest of wills. We must force him to do something he really doesn't want to do," Nell said, thinking aloud. "What would fit that bill?"
"Wake him up," Nell said.
"Tell him you were lying when you said this wasn't a Kryptonet operation. Tell him you want real information. You want military secrets." Miss Braithwaite sent the maid out for a bucket of cold water and heaved it over Colonel Napier's body. Then she played the role as Nell had suggested, and did it well. Madame Ping hired people who were good at improvisation. And since most of them never actually had to have sex with the clients, she had no trouble finding good ones. Colonel Napier seemed surprised, not unpleasantly so, at the script change. "If you suppose that I will divulge information that might lead to the deaths of more of my soldiers, you are sadly mistaken," he said. But his voice sounded a little bored and disappointed, and the bio-readouts coming in from the nanocytes in his body did not show the full flush of sexual excitement that presumably he was paying for. They still were not meeting their clients' needs. On the private channel to Miss Braithwaite, Nell said, "He still doesn't get it. This isn't a fantasy scenario anymore. This is real. Madame Ping's is actually a Kryptonet operation. We've been drawing him in for the last several years. Now he belongs to us, and he's going to give us information, and he's going to keep giving it to us because he's our slave." Miss Braithwaite acted the scene as suggested, making up more florid dialogue as she went along. Watching the bio readouts, Nell could see that Colonel Napier was just as scared and excited now as he had been on his very first visit to Madame Ping's several years ago. They kept records. They were making him feel young again and fully alive. "Are you connected with Dr. X?" Colonel Napier said. "We'll ask the questions," Nell said. "I shall do the asking. Lotus, give him 20 for that," said Miss Braithwaite, and the maid went to work on Colonel Napier with a cane. The rest of the session almost ran itself, which was good for Nell, because she had been startled by Napier's reference to Dr. X and had gone into a reverie, remembering comments that Harve had made about the same person many years ago. Miss Braithwaite knew her job and understood Nell's strategy instantly. The scenario did not excite the client unless there was a genuine contest of wills, and the only way for them to create that contest was to force Napier to reveal real classified information. Reveal it he did, bit by bit, under the encouragement of Lotus's bamboo and Miss Braithwaite's voice. Most of it had to do with troop movements and other minutiae that he probably thought was terribly interesting. Nell didn't.
"Get more about Dr. X," she said. "Why did he assume a connection between Kryptonet and Dr. X?"
After a few more minutes of whacking and verbal domination, Colonel Napier was ready to spill.
"Big operation of ours for many years now. Dr. X is working in collusion with a high-level Kryptonet figure, the Alchemist, working on something they mustn't be allowed to have."
"Don't you dare hold back on me," Miss Braithwaite said.
But before she could extract more information about the Alchemist, the building was jolted by a tremendous force that sent thin cracks racing through the old concrete. In the silence that followed, Nell could hear women screaming all over the building and a crackling, hissing sound as dust and sand sifted out of a fissure in the ceiling. Then her ears began to resolve another sound. Men shouting, "Sha! Sha!"
I suggest that someone has just breached the wall of your building with an explosive charge, Colonel Napier said, perfectly calm. If you would be so good as to terminate the scenario now and release me, I shall try to make myself useful in whatever is to follow.
Whatever is to follow.
The shouting meant simply, kill, kill, and was the battle cry of the Fists of Righteous Harmony. Perhaps they wanted Colonel Napier, but it was more likely that they had decided to attack this place for its symbolic value as a den of barbarian decadence. Miss Braithwaite and Lotus had already gotten Colonel Napier out of his restraints, and he was pulling on his trousers. That we are not all dead implies that they are not making use of nanotechnological methods, he said professorially. Hence, this attack may safely be assumed to originate from a low-level neighborhood cell. The attackers probably believe the Fist doctrine, that they are immune from all weapons. It never hurts in these situations to give them a reality check of some sort. The door to Napier's room flew open, splinters of blonde, naked wood hissing across the floor. Nell watched, as though watching an old movie, as Colonel Napier drew a ridiculously shiny cavalry saber from its scabbard and ran it through the chest of the attacking Fist. This one fell back into another, creating momentary confusion. Napier took advantage of it, methodically planting his feet in a rather prissy-looking stance, squaring his shoulders, calmly reaching out as if he were using the saber to poke around in a dark closet, and twitching the point beneath the second Fist's chin, incidentally cutting his throat in the process. A third Fist had gotten into the room by this point, this one bearing a long pole with a knife lashed to the end of it with gray polymer ribbon peasants used for rope. But as he tried to wheel the weapon around, its butt end got tangled up in the rack to which Napier had lately been tied. Napier stepped forward cautiously, checking his footing as he went, as if he did not want to get any blood on his boots, parried a belated attack, and stabbed the Fist in the thorax 3 times in quick succession. Someone kicked at the door to Nell's room. Ah, Colonel Napier sighed, when it seemed clear that there were no more attackers in this party. It is really very singular that I happen to have brought this full dress uniform, as edged weapons are not a part of our usual kit. Several kicks had failed to open Nell's door, which, unlike the ones in the scenario rooms, was made of a modern substance and could not possibly be broken down in that way. But Nell could hear voices out in the corridor and suspected that, contrary to Napier's speculation, they might have nanotech devices of a very primitive sort, small explosives, say, capable of blowing doors open. She ditched her long dress, which would only get in the way, and got down on knees and elbows to peer through the crack under the door. There were 2 pairs of feet. She could hear them conversing in low, business-like tones. Nell opened the door suddenly with one hand, reaching through with the other to shove a fountain pen into the throat of the Fist standing closest to the door. The other one reached for an old automatic rifle slung over his shoulder. This gave Nell more than enough time to kick him in the knee, which may or may not have done permanent damage, but certainly threw him off balance. The Fist kept trying to bring his rifle to bear as Nell kicked him over and over again. In the end, she was able to twist the rifle free from his feeble one-handed grasp, whirl it around, and butt him in the head. The Fist with the pen in his neck was sitting on the floor watching her calmly. She aimed the rifle his way, and he held up one hand and looked down and away. His wound was bleeding, but not all that much. She had ruined his week, but not hit anything big. She reflected that it was probably a healthy thing for him in the long run to be rid of the superstition that he was immune to weapons. Constable Moore had taught her a thing or two about rifles. She stepped back into her room, locked the door, and devoted a minute or so to familiarizing herself with its controls, checking the magazine, only half full, and firing a single round into the door which stopped it, just to make sure it worked. She was trying to suppress a flashback to the screwdriver incident. This frightened her until she realized that this time around she was much more in control of the situation. Her conversations with the constable had not been without effect. Then she made her way down the corridor and stairwells toward the lobby, slowly gathering a retinue of terrified young women along her way. They passed a few clients, mostly male and mostly European, who had been pulled from their scenario rooms and crudely hacked up by the Fists. 3 times she had to fire, surprised each time at how complicated it was. Accustomed to the primer, Nell had to make allowances when functioning in the real world. She and her followers found Colonel Napier in the lobby, about 3/4 dressed, carrying on a memorable edged weapons duel with a couple of fists who had, perhaps, been left there to keep the path of escape open. Nell considered trying to shoot at the fists, but decided against it, because she did not trust her marksmanship and also because she was mesmerized by the entire scene. Nell would have been dazzled by Colonel Napier if she had not recently seen him strapped to a rack. Still, there was something about this very contradiction that made him, and by extension all Victorian men, fascinating to her. They lived a life of nearly perfect emotional denial, a form of asceticism as extreme as that of a medieval stylite. Yet they did have emotions, the same as anyone else, and only vented them in carefully selected circumstances. Napier calmly impaled a fist who had tripped and fallen, then turned his attention to a new antagonist, a formidable character skilled with a real sword. The duel between Western and Eastern martial arts moved back and forth across the lobby floor, the two combatants staring directly into one another's eyes and trying to intuit the other's thoughts and emotional state. The actual thrusts and parries and ripostes, when they came, were too rapid to be understood. The fist style was quite beautiful to watch, involving many slow movements that looked like the stretching of large felines at the zoo. Napier's style was almost perfectly boring. He moved about in a crabbed stance, watched his opponent calmly, and apparently did a lot of deep thinking. Watching Napier at work, watching the medals and braids swinging and glinting on his jacket, Nell realized that it was precisely their emotional repression that made the Victorians the richest and most powerful people in the world. Their ability to submerge their feelings, far from pathological, was rather a kind of mystical art that gave them nearly magical power over nature and over the more intuitive tribes. Such was also the strength of the Nipponese. Before the struggle could be resolved, a smart flechette, horsefly size, trailing a whip antenna as thick as a hair and as long as a finger, hissed in through a broken window and thunked into the back of the fist's neck. It did not strike very hard, but must have shot some poison into his brain. He sat down quickly on the floor, closed his eyes, and died in that position. "Not very chivalrous," Colonel Napier said distastefully. "I suppose I have some bureaucrat up on New Chuzan to thank for that." A cautious tour of the building turned up several more fists who had died in the same fashion. Outside, the same old crowd of refugees, beggars, pedestrians, and cargo-carrying bicyclists streamed on, about as undisturbed as the Yangtze. Colonel Napier did not return to Madame Ping's the next week, but Madame Ping did not blame Nell for the loss of his custom. To the contrary, she praised Nell for having correctly divined Napier's wishes and for improvising so well. "A fine performance," she said. Nell had not really thought of her work as a performance, and for some reason Madame Ping's choice of words provoked her in a way that kept her awake late that night, staring into the darkness above her bunk. Since she had been very small, she had made up stories and recited them to the primer, which were often digested and incorporated into the primer's stories. It had come naturally to Nell to do the same work for Madame Ping. But now her boss was calling it a performance, and Nell had to admit that it was in a way. Her stories were being digested not by the primer, but by another human being, becoming a part of that person's mind. That seemed simple enough, but the notion troubled her for a reason that did not become clear until she had lain half asleep and fretted over it for several hours. Colonel Napier did not know her, and probably never would. All of the intercourse between him and Nell had been mediated through the actress pretending to be Miss Braithwaite, and through various technological systems. Nonetheless, she had touched him deeply. She had penetrated farther into his soul than any lover. If Colonel Napier had chosen to return the following week, and Nell had not been present to make up the story for him, would he have missed her? Nell suspected that he would have. From his point of view, some indefinable essence would have been wanting, and he would have departed unsatisfied. If this could happen to Colonel Napier in his dealings with Madame Ping, could it happen to Nell in her dealings with the primer? She had always felt that there was some essence in the book, something that understood her, and even loved her. Something that forgave her when she did wrong and appreciated what she did right. When she'd been very young, she hadn't questioned this at all. It had been part of the book's magic.
More recently, she had understood it as the workings of a parallel computer of enormous size and power, carefully programmed to understand the human mind and give it what it needed. Now she wasn't so sure. Princess Nell's recent travels through the lands of King Coyote and the various castles with their increasingly sophisticated computers that were, in the end, nothing more than Turing machines, had caught her up in a bewildering logical circle. In Castle Turing, she had learned that a Turing machine could not really understand a human being. But the Primer was, itself, a Turing machine, or so she suspected. So how could it understand Nell? Could it be that the Primer was just a conduit? A technological system that mediated between Nell and some human being who really loved her? In the end, she knew this was basically how all reactives worked. The idea was too alarming to consider at first, and so she circled around it cautiously, poking at it from different directions, like a cavewoman discovering fire for the first time. But as she settled in closer, she found that it warmed her and satisfied her, and by the time her mind wandered into sleep, she had become dependent upon it and would not consider going back into the cold and dark place where she had been traveling for so many years. Carl Hollywood returns to Shanghai. His forebears in the territory of the Lone Eagles. Mrs. Kwan's Tea House. Heavy rains had come rolling into Shanghai from the west, like a harbinger of the fists of righteous harmony and the thundering herald of the coming celestial kingdom. Stepping off the airship from London, Carl Hollywood at once felt himself in a different Shanghai from the one he had left. The old city had always been wild, but in a sophisticated urban way, and now it was wild like a frontier town. He sensed this ambience before he even left the aerodrome. It leaked in from the streets like ozone before a thunderstorm. Looking out the windows, he could see a heavy rain rushing down, knocking all the nanotech out of the air and down into the gutters, whence it would eventually stain the Huangpu and then the Yangtze. Whether it was the wild atmosphere or the prospect of being rained upon, he stopped his porters short of the main exit doors so that he could change hats. The hat boxes were stacked on one of the carts. His bowler went into the smallest and topmost box, which was empty, and then he yanked the largest box out from underneath, popping the stack, and took out a 10-gallon Stetson of breathtaking width and sweep, almost like a head-mounted umbrella. Casting an eye into the street, where a rushing brown stream carried litter, road dust, cholera-ridden sewage, and tons of captive nanotech toward the storm drains, he slipped off his leather shoes and exchanged them for a pair of hand-tooled cowboy boots made from hides of gaudy reptiles and avians, the pores of which had been corked with mites that would keep his feet dry even if he chose to wade through the gutters. Thus reconfigured, Carl Hollywood stepped out into the streets of Shanghai. As he came out of the doors of the aerodrome, his duster billowed in the cold wind of the storm, and even the beggars stepped away from him. He paused to light a cigar before proceeding, and was not molested. Even the refugees, who were starving, or at least claimed to be, derived more enjoyment from simply looking at him than they would have from the coins in his pocket. He walked the four blocks to his hotel, pursued doggedly by the porters and by a crowd of youngsters entranced by the sight of a real cowboy. Carl's grandfather was a Lone Eagle, who had ridden out from the crowding and squalor of Silicon Valley in the 1990s and homesteaded a patch of abandoned ranch along a violent cold river on the eastern slope of the Wind River Range. From there, he had made a comfortable living as a freelance coder and consultant. His wife had left him for the bright lights and social life of California, and been startled when he had managed to persuade a judge that he was better equipped to raise their son than she was. Grandfather had raised Carl Hollywood's father mostly in the out-of-doors, hunting and fishing and chopping wood when he wasn't sitting inside studying his calculus. As the years went by, they had gradually been joined by like-minded sorts with similar stories to tell, so that by the time of the interregnum, they had formed a community of several hundred, loosely spread over a few thousand square miles of near wilderness, but in the electronic sense, as tightly knit as any small village in the Old West. Their technological prowess, prodigious wealth,
and numerous large weapons had made them a dangerous group, and the odd pickup truck-driving desperados who attacked an isolated ranch had found themselves surrounded and outgunned with cataclysmic swiftness. Grandfather loved to tell stories of these criminals, how they had tried to excuse their own crimes by pleading that they were economically disadvantaged or infected with the disease of substance abuse, and how the lone eagles, many of whom had overcome poverty or addiction themselves, had dispatched them with firing squads and left them posted around the edge of their territory as no trespassing signs that even the illiterate could read. The advent of the Common Economic Protocol had settled things down and, in the eyes of the old-timers, begun to soften and ruin the place. There was nothing like getting up at 3 in the morning and riding the defensive perimeter in sub-zero cold with a loaded rifle to build up one's sense of responsibility and community. Carl Hollywood's clearest and best memories were of going on such rides with his father. But as they squatted on packed snow, boiling coffee over a fire, they would listen to the radio and hear stories about the jihad raging across Xinjiang, driving the Han back into the East, and about the first incidents of nanotech terrorism in Eastern Europe. Carl's father didn't have to tell him that their community was rapidly acquiring the character of a historical theme park, and that before long they would have to give up the mounted patrols for more modern defensive systems. Even after those innovations had been made and the community had mostly joined up with the First Distributed Republic, Carl and his father and grandfather had continued to do things in the old way, hunting elk and heating their houses with wood-burning stoves and sitting behind their computer screens in dark rooms late into the night, hand-tooling code in assembly language. It was a purely male household. Carl's mother had died when he was 9 years old in a rafting accident. And Carl had fled the place as soon as he'd found a way, going to San Francisco, then New York, then London, and making himself useful in theatrical productions. But the older he got, the more he understood in how many ways he was rooted in the place where he grew up. And he never felt it more purely than he did striding down a crowded street in a Shanghai thunderstorm, puffing on a thick cigar and watching the rain dribble from the rim of his hat. The most intense and clear sensations of his life had flooded into his young and defenseless mind during his first dawn patrol, knowing the desperados were out there somewhere. He kept returning to these memories in later life, trying to recapture the same purity and intensity of sensation, or trying to get his raptors to feel it. Now, for the first time in 30 years, he felt the same thing, this time on the streets of Shanghai, hot and pulsing on the edge of a dynastic rebellion, like the arteries of an old man about to have his first orgasm in years.